The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article today is from the technology section. The name of this article is, It's Time to Give Up on Ending Social Media's Misinformation Problem. There's a better approach to keeping users safe. And this was written by Scott Duke Comeners and Jesse Shapiro. If you don't trust social media, you should know that you're not alone. Most people surveyed around the world feel the same. In fact, they've been saying so for a decade. There is clearly a problem with misinformation and hazardous speech on platforms such as Facebook and X. And before the end of its term this year, the Supreme Court may redefine how that problem is treated. Over the past few weeks, the court has heard arguments in three cases that deal with controlling political speech and misinformation online. In the first two, heard last month, lawmakers in Texas and Florida claim that platforms such as Facebook are selectively removing political content that its moderators deem harmful or otherwise against their terms of service. Tech companies have argued that they have the right to curate what their users see. Meanwhile, some policymakers believe that content moderation hasn't gone far enough, and that misinformation still flows too easily through social networks. Whether and how government officials can directly communicate with tech platforms about removing such content is at issue in the third case, which was put before the court this week. We're Harvard economists who study social media and platform design. Our research offers perhaps a counterintuitive solution to disagreements about moderation. Platforms should give up on trying to prevent the spread of information that is simply false and focus instead on preventing the spread of information that can be used to cause harm. These are related issues, but they're not the same. As the presidential election approaches, tech platforms are gearing up for a deluge of misinformation. Civil society organizations say that platforms need a better plan to combat election misinformation, and some academics expect to reach new heights this year. Platforms say they have plans for keeping sites secure, yet despite the resources devoted to content moderation, fact-checking, and the like, it's hard to escape the feeling that the tech titans are losing the fight. Here is the issue. Platforms have the power to block, flag, or mute content that they judge to be false. But blocking or flagging something as false doesn't necessarily stop users from believing it. Indeed, because many of the most pernicious lies are believed by those inclined to distrust the, quote, establishment, end quote, blocking or flagging false claims can even make things worse. On December 19, 2020, then-President Donald Trump posted a now infamous message about election fraud, telling his readers to be there in Washington, D.C. on January 6th. If you visit that post on Facebook today, you'll see a sober annotation from the platform itself that, quote, the U.S. has laws, procedures, and established institutions to ensure the integrity of our elections, end quote. That disclaimer is sourced from the Bipartisan Policy Center. But does anyone seriously believe that the people storming the Capitol on January 6th and the many others who cheered them on would be convinced that Joe Biden won just because the Bipartisan Policy Center told Facebook that everything was okay? Our research shows that this problem is intrinsic. Unless a platform's users trust the platform's motivations and its process, any action by the platform can look like evidence of something it is not. To reach this conclusion, we built a mathematical model. In the model, one user, a sender, tries to make a claim to another user, a receiver. The claim might be true or false, harmful or not. Between the two users is a platform, or maybe an algorithm acting on its behalf, that can block the sender's content if it wants to. We wanted to find out when blocking content can improve outcomes without a risk of making them worse. Our model, like all models, is an abstraction, and thus imperfectly captures the complexity of actual interactions. But because we wanted to consider all possible policies, not just those that have been tried in practice, our question couldn't be answered by data alone. So instead, we approached it using mathematical logic, treating the model as a kind of wind tunnel to test the effectiveness of different policies. Our analysis showed that if users trust the platform to both know what's right and do what's right, and the platform truly does know what's true and what isn't, then the platform can successfully eliminate misinformation. The logic is simple. If users believe the platform is benevolent and all-knowing, then if something is blocked or flagged, it must be false. And if it is let through, it must be true. You can see the problem, though. Many users don't trust big tech platforms, as those previously mentioned surveys demonstrate. When users don't trust a platform, even well-meaning attempts to make things better can make things worse. And when the platforms seem to be taking sides, that can add fuel to the very fire they are trying to put out. Does this mean that content moderation is always counterproductive? Far from it. Our analysis also shows that moderation can be very effective when it blocks information that can be used to do something harmful. Going back to Trump's December 2020 post about election fraud, imagine that, instead of alerting users to the sober conclusions of the Bipartisan Policy Center, the platform had simply made it much harder for Trump to communicate the date, January 6th, and place, Washington, D.C., for supporters to gather. Blocking that information wouldn't have prevented users from believing that the election was stolen. To the contrary, it might have fed claims that tech sector elites were trying to influence the outcome. Nevertheless, making it harder to coordinate where and when it to go might have helped slow the momentum of the eventual insurrection, thus limiting the post's real-world harms. Unlike removing misinformation per se, removing information that enables harm can work even if users don't trust the platform's motives at all. When it is the information itself that enables the harm, blocking that information blocks the harm as well. A similar logic extends to other kinds of harmful content, such as doxing and hate speech. There, the content itself, not the beliefs it encourages, is the root of the harm, and platforms do indeed successfully moderate these types of content. Do we want tech companies to decide what is and what is not harmful? Maybe not. The challenges and downsides are clear. But platforms already routinely make judgments about harm. Is a post calling for a gathering at a particular place and time that includes the word violent and incident to violence, or an announcement of an outdoor concert? Clearly the latter if you're planning to see the violent femmes. Often, context and language make these judgments apparent enough that an algorithm can determine them. When that doesn't happen, platforms can rely on internal experts or even independent bodies, such as Meta's Oversight Board, which handles tricky cases related to the company's content policies. And if platforms accept our reasoning, they can divert resources from the misguided task of deciding what is true toward the still hard but more pragmatic task of determining what enables harm. Even though misinformation is a huge problem, it's not one that platforms can solve. Platforms can keep us safer by focusing on what content moderation can do and giving up on what it can't. Our next article is The True Cost of the Church Going Bust by Derek Thompson. This is from Work in Progress, a newsletter about work, technology, and how to solve some of America's biggest problems. As an agnostic, I have spent most of my life thinking about the decline of faith in America in mostly positive terms. Organized religion seemed to me beset by scandal and entangled in noxious politics. So I thought, what is there really to mourn? Only in the past few years have I come around to a different view. Maybe religion, for all of its faults, works a bit like a retaining wall to hold back the destabilizing pressure of American hyper-individualism, which threatens to swell and spill over in its absence. More than one quarter of Americans now identify as atheists, agnostics, or religiously unaffiliated, according to a new survey of 5,600 U.S. adults by the Public Religion Research Institute. This is the highest level of non-religiosity in the poll's history. Two-thirds of believers were brought up in at least nominally religious households, like me. I grew up in a Reform Jewish home that I would describe as haphazardly religious. My parents encouraged my sister and me to enthusiastically celebrate Hanukkah and just as fervently to believe in Santa Claus. Secularization is old news. The scientific revolution that pitted the church against stargazers like Galileo comes from the 1600s, and Nietzsche famously declared God is dead in the 1880s. But even as secularism surged throughout the developed world in the 20th century, America's religiosity remained exceptional. 7 in 10 Americans told Gallup that they belonged to a church in 1937, and by the 1980s, roughly 70% still said they still belonged to a church, synagogue, or mosque. Suddenly, in the 1990s, the ranks of non-believers surged. An estimated 40 million people, 1 in 8 Americans, stopped going to church in the past 25 years, making it the largest concentrated change in church attendance in American history, according to the religion writer Jake Meador. In 2021, membership in houses of worship fell below a majority for the first time on record. The sudden decline of religion likely relates to changes in both politics and family life. In the 1970s and 80s, the religious right became a formidable fundraising machine for the Republican Party. As the GOP consolidated its advantage among conservative Christians, religion seemed less appealing to liberal young people, especially if they or their parents already had a tenuous relationship with the church. In the late 1980s, only 1 in 10 liberals said they didn't belong to any religion. 30 years later, that figure was about 4 in 10. Meanwhile, the decline of marriage, especially among low-income Americans, accompanied their move from the church. That relationship with organized religion provided many things at once. Not only a connection to the divine, but also a historical narrative of identity, a set of rituals to organize the week and year, and a community of families. PRRI found that the most important feature of religion for the dwindling number of Americans who still attend services a few times a year included experiencing religion in a community and instilling values in their children. When I read the Public Religion Research Institute survey, this emphasis on community is what caught my eye. As recently reported, the United States is in the midst of a historically unprecedented decline in face-to-face socializing. The social collapse is steepest for some of the groups with the largest declines in religiosity. For example, young people who are fleeing religion faster than older Americans have also seen the largest decline in socializing. Boys and girls ages 15 to 19 have reduced their hangouts by more than 3 hours a week, according to the American Time Use Survey. There is no statistical record of any period of in U.S. history where young people were less likely to attend religious services, and also no period when young people have spent more time on their own. A similar story holds for working-class Americans. In 2019, a team of researchers published a survey based on long interviews conducted from 2000 to 2013 with older, low-income men without a college degree in working-class neighborhoods around the country. They found that, since the 1970s, church attendance among white men without a college degree had fallen even more among than among white college graduates. For many of these men, the loss of religion went hand in hand with the retreat from marriage. As marriage declined, the authors wrote, men's church attendance might have fallen in tandem. Today, low-income and unmarried men have more alone time than almost any other group, according to time use data. Did the decline of religion cut some people off from a crucial gateway to civic engagement? Or is religion just one part of a broader retreat from associations and memberships in America? It's hard to know what the causal story is here, Eric Kleinenberg, a sociologist at NYU, told me. But what's undeniable is that non-religious Americans are also less civically engaged. This year, the Pew Research Center reported that religiously unaffiliated Americans are less likely to volunteer, less likely to feel satisfied with their community and social life, and more likely to say they feel lonely. Clearly, more Americans are spending Sunday mornings on their couches, and it's affected the quality of our collective life, he said. Kleinenberg doesn't blame individual Americans for these changes. He sees our civic retreat as a story about place. In his book, Palaces for the People, Kleinenberg reported that Americans today have fewer shared spaces where connections are formed. People today say they just have fewer places to go for collective life, he said. Places that used to anchor community life, like libraries and school gyms and union halls, have become less accessible or shuttered altogether. Many people, having lost the scaffolding of organized religion, seem to have found no alternative method to build a sense of community. Imagine, by analogy, a parallel universe where Americans suddenly gave up on sit-down restaurants. In surveys, they named many reasonable motivations for their abstinence: the expense, the overuse of salt and sugar and butter, the temptation to drink alcohol. As restaurants disappeared by the hundreds, some mourned their closure, while others said it simply didn't matter. After all, there were still plenty of ways for people to feed themselves. Over time, however, Americans as a group never found another social activity to replace their dining out time. They saw less of one another with each passing decade. Sociologists noted that the demise of restaurants had correlated with a rise in aloneness, just as the CDC noticed an increase in anxiety and depression. I've come to believe that something like this story is happening, except with organized religion playing the role of restaurants. On an individual basis, people can give any number of valid-sounding reasons for not frequenting a house of worship. But a behavioral shift that is fully understandable on the individual level has coincided with, and even partly exacerbated, a great rewiring of our social relations. And America didn't simply lose its religion without finding a communal replacement. Just as America's churches were depopulated, Americans developed a new relationship with a technology that, in many ways, is the diabolical opposite of a religious ritual, the smartphone. As the social psychologist Jonathan Haidt writes in his new book, The Anxious Generation, to stare into a piece of glass in our hands is to be removed from our bodies, to float placelessly in a content cosmos, to skim our attention from one piece of ephemera to the next. The internet is timeless in the best and worst of ways, and everything store with no opening or closing times. In the virtual world, there is no daily, weekly, or annual calendar that structures when people can and cannot do things, Haidt writes. In other words, digital life is disembodied, asynchronous, shallow, and solitary. Religious rituals are the opposite in almost every respect. They put us in our body, Haidt writes, many of them requiring some kind of movement that marks the activity as devotional. Christians kneel, Muslims prostrate, and Jews divan. Religious rituals also fixes us in time, forcing us to set aside an hour or day for prayer, reflection, or separation from daily habit. It's no surprise that people describe a scheduled break from their digital devices as a, quote, Sabbath. Finally, religious ritual often requires that we make contact with the sacred in the presence of other people, whether in a church, mosque, synagogue, or over a dinner table prayer. In other words, the religious ritual is typically embodied, synchronous, deep, and collective. I'm not advocating that every atheist and agnostic in America immediately choose a world religion and commit themselves to weekly church or synagogue or mosque attendance, but I wonder if, in foregoing organized religion, an isolated country has discarded an old and proven source of ritual at a time when we most need it. Making friends as an adult can be hard, especially hard without a scheduled weekly reunion of congregants. Finding meaning in the world is hard, too. It's especially difficult if the oldest systems of meaning-making hold less and less appeal. It took decades for Americans to lose religion. It might take decades to understand the entirety of what we lost. Next, Why People Wait 10 Days to Do Something That Takes 10 Minutes, by Amanda Maul. I'm trying to construct an alternative theory of myself in which I'm a tidy person. It's not going well. Walking my recycling from my apartment to the trash down the hall takes me anywhere from 2 minutes to a month. I hate looking at broken-down boxes and empty LaCroix cans in my apartment, but studies say humans are bad at prioritizing longer-term goals over instant gratification, and I apparently find doing anything else much more gratifying. It doesn't take a scientist to explain why I might put off other things, such as doing my dishes. Those are annoying and kind of gross, and the primary reward is just being able to use them in the future. Still, at a certain point, the anxiety of having not done these tasks surpasses the annoyance of doing them in the first place. That's an entirely predictable cycle that many otherwise productive people find in themselves in when it comes to simple household chores. A chore that I could feel good about completing in 10 minutes instead stresses me out for days or weeks. It can be hard to understand why this behavior is so common. The topic is tempting fodder for self-styled gurus wielding empty motivational platitudes, but the underlying cause is complex, an odd cocktail of emotional and psychological dynamics, all conspiring to let my bedding remain dirty for another week. According to the DePaul University psychology professor Joseph Ferrari, there are two distinct types of people who have a problem completing household chores in a timely manner: task delayers and chronic procrastinators. The scientific distinction between the two is hazy, but it comes down to pervasiveness. You might feel overwhelmed by your aversion to housework, but on its own, it's not enough to be indicative of a chronic problem. All people procrastinate sometimes, Ferrari says, but for chronic procrastinators, it happens in all areas of life and has a negative impact on a person's health and relationships. It's a lifestyle of avoidance, he says. Ferrari's research finds that description applies to about 20% of people. Simple task delayers are more common, but they usually have a much easier time building better habits than their chronic counterparts, which is good news for people whose primary problem is chore procrastination. We're not that bad. Part of the reason task delayers are lulled into their bad habits in the first place might be the time of day or week when chores often occur. Doing those tasks takes some self-control, and if you've made a lot of choices already that day, it's harder to exert self-control, says Roy Baumeister, a social psychologist and Florida State University professor. Baumeister is referring to a somewhat contested theory called decision fatigue, which holds that people's brains get worn out by the necessity of being decisive and exercising restraint, usually at work. Guilt and shame can be big parts of procrastination if the procrastinator begins to internalize the desire to avoid dirty dishes as indicative of larger moral failures. We bring other things to this besides the task itself, and we tell ourselves stories about who we could be if we just buckled down and did that thing, says Liz Sumner, a life coach who helps older women break bad habits and be more productive. Sumner recommends breaking tasks into small, manageable steps, but those efforts can still be thwarted when people worry they aren't changing or progressing quickly enough. A big problem here is that they attack themselves and not their behaviors, Ferrari says. If task delayers can depersonalize their aversion to, say, vacuuming or litter box changing, he believes, they stand a better chance of being able to evaluate it rationally, avoiding the shame cycle that can calcify negative behaviors into bad habits. If a problem can be understood, maybe it can be fixed. Betsy Burroughs, a Silicon Valley branding executive turned neuroscience researcher, used to have a hard time keeping her home tidy. It was just a disaster all the time, she says. But then I noticed that if I was having people over, not only would I clean up the place, but I'd actually enjoy cleaning it. Her solution was to start a monthly conversation salon at her San Francisco loft, which ran for more than 12 years. Starting your own event series might seem a little extreme for most people, but the idea of recognizing what you dislike and recontextualizing it as an element of something positive can be applied to most housework. Being conscious of your habits does seem to have an impact on procrastination, but in ways more complicated than I had first assumed. In 2011, the Stanford University researcher Carol Dweck published findings that suggest decision fatigue more negatively affects people who have already expect their willpower to be low. People who expect themselves to fail toward the end of the day, in other words, often do. Maybe task delayers could all be better around the house if we simply stopped granting the premise that bad is the default with which we are stricken. Procrastination researchers, it should be mentioned, all seem to answer their emails in a timely manner. Still, a certain level of delay might just be an inescapable part of the human brain, especially when the task is tricky. When I asked Ferrari what the inflection point is between being a task delayer and a chronic procrastinator, he told me that was a complicated question. Every 2 years, researchers on procrastination have an international meeting. We've been doing it for 20 years, he says. After each of these meetings, we walk away saying that we've got to get people to understand the difference between delaying and procrastination. They haven't arrived at an answer yet. Maybe the time for it, like the time for my recycling, will come soon. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Have a great day.